We are starting a six-week series entitled Ragged to Restored in relationships on the way from Jacob to Israel. The first thing that might make you go, huh, is what does this Jacob to Israel thing? Israel, that is both the location now, but it's also the name of Jacob. Jacob receives the name Israel upon a life-changing event where he wrestles with a man who is identified as God in the text and the scriptures all night long at a place called Peniel. And that he wrestles and he has overcome and is wrestling and is asking for a blessing. And we're going to get to that text in a couple of weeks. But that Jacob, whose name, which we'll read about today, means heel grabber or has a connotation of deceitfulness, that Jacob receives a new name upon this radical, life-changing altercation and confrontation with the presence of God. And so he receives the name Israel, meaning I wrestled with God and have overcome. You have wrestled with God and overcome. So we're going to be Genesis 25. The other thing that we need to recognize as we enter into a series on relationships, we're talking about relationships, we need to recognize that our entire lives are centered around the fact that we're related to things. You all have last names, right? If anyone has a last name, please raise your hand. Very good. So you have a last name. Guess what that means? How many of you in the room have a last name that there's somebody else that has your last name? Oh, wow. Okay. But that if you have, I'm saying even your mom, your dad, your brother, your sister, they share a last name with you. That means in some form or fashion to describe Bane Sakadusky, I need to somehow reference her to Mike. To talk about Bane is to talk about Mike. To talk about Martin is to talk about Susan. To talk about Scott is to talk about Debbie, because they share identity. There's relationships there that are important. I could go further. I don't know some of your parents and those types of things, but to talk about you is to talk about mom and dad. So, for example, I know Tom has his daughter Amy with him this morning. And so if I'm going to talk about Amy, I got to talk about Tom. It's just, it has to happen, because those relationships are a part of who we are. We find ourselves in context. For me, I can find people in Germany who have the last name Hoffman, which was my family surname before my great-grandfather decided to change it. He was Hans Hoffman and became Richard Ryder, but that partly because he was afraid of the German Navy, and they were searching for him, he was concerned, but that there are Hoffmans in Germany that are connected to me, that share blood with me, that are part of my family story if I went back long enough. And the reality is that each of you are like that. And I believe that part of what it means when God says in Genesis 1, let us make man in our image, that this isn't just a good proof text to talk about the Trinity, but what is really being discussed is that God is in relationship, Father, Son, Holy Spirit, from eternity to eternity. And that being made in that image means that, guess what? If you are going to be what God has designed you to be as a human, you need to be in relationships with other people. The way that the one poet says is, no man is an island. It's true. If you're going to be a healthy human, it means that you're going to have relationships with people. So I want us to start there. Now, the problem is that you and I both know that relationships don't always go the way that we want them to go or the way that we anticipate them to go. We're broken people, we're hurting people, and that we sometimes make bad decisions on purpose. Sometimes we make bad decisions and they're not on purpose. Sometimes we make really good decisions on purpose, and sometimes we make really good decisions we had no idea we made a good decision. But that the reality is all of those things work together to create relationships for us that can create some of the highest joys and some of the deepest pains of our lives. That the absolute mountaintops of the goodness of life are found inside of these relationships. One of the greatest days of my life was July 10th, 2004, the day I got married. And that parts of that day are just are so ingrained in me. But I can tell you some of the rocky moments inside of that same relationship. I can tell you about December 15th, 2012, one of the most miserable days of my life. And that inside of that same relationship, that the highest of highs and the lowest of lows occurred. So this series is meant to help us grab hold of what does God really want for our relationships? What is God really interested in as we interact with our spouses, with our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, if you have them, our coworkers, our neighbors, our aunts, our uncles, our whoever's? How do we interact? What is God's design for that? And we're going to look through the lens of a man who struggled with relationships as well in the person of Jacob. We are going to focus a little bit more on people connected to Jacob sometimes. So for this morning, we're going to spend a significant amount of time on Esau. But that it's important to understand the web of and context of relationships of Jacob's life and how that affects us. So with that in mind, we're going to jump into the text now. Genesis 25, starting at verse 21. And Isaac prayed to the Lord for his wife because she was barren. And the Lord granted his prayer, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. The children struggled together within her, and she said, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" Imagine some of you who have carried children had gotten to some point in your pregnancy and said, "Why, God, did I decide to do this?" So she went to inquire of the Lord, and the Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." When her days to give birth were completed, behold, there were two twins. There were twins in her womb. The first came out red, all his body like a hairy cloak, so they called his name Esau. Afterward, his brother came out with his hand holding Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. Isaac was 60 years old when she bore them. When the boys grew up, Esau was a skillful hunter, a man of the field, while Jacob was a quiet man, dwelling in tents. Isaac loved Esau because he ate of his game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. Once when Jacob was cooking stew, Esau came in from the field, and he was exhausted. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me eat some of that red stew, for I am exhausted." Therefore, his name is called Edom. Jacob said, "Sell me your birthright now." Esau said, "I am about to die. Of what use is a birthright to me?" Jacob said, "Swear to me now." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. Despised his birthright. This is the word of the Lord for the nurture and admonition of his people today. Thanks be to God. Thanks be to God. To really grab hold of this text, we need to understand that we live, as do all cultures, in a world in which that there are social conventions or a conventional wisdom, if you will, that exists. Part of Esau and Jacob's conventional wisdom in their day was that the oldest son was to receive the mantle of leadership from his father. And you got to remember, these are pastoralists, these are nomads that wander the arid regions of Israel and modern-day Syria, and that they look for pasture for their sheep and their goats, and that they go around, they follow where the water is to be able to feed them and to give them drink. But that these pastoralist families, that there was a very much a patriarchy involved, that the father, the oldest male of the group, bore the leadership responsibility, that he was the one that gave the say of, "This is where we're going, this is when we're going, this is what we're doing, this is how we're going to do it." It was his responsibility, and that the social convention was that the oldest son would be the one that would end up receiving that type of leadership responsibility. The other piece of the social convention, which many of you know about, is that the oldest son also received the largest portion, a significantly largest portion of the inheritance of his father. And so thus, for example, the prodigal son story, when the youngest asks for his share of the inheritance, he's actually not receiving nearly as much as the older son. The older son receives significantly more than what the younger son will receive. Now, There's this is part of the world. Now, if you don't think, we have these types of social customs as well. It's why this one that I'm about to share with you is dying in our culture. But back in the 50s and 60s and so on and so forth, that part of the social customs and norms, the conventional wisdom of our culture was the so-called American dream. That you got married, you settled down, you had 2.5 kids, a dog, a cat, and a white picket fence. I'm not completely sure how you get the 0.5 kid. It's half-baked, I suppose. But that you don't, you have that reality there. That this is what the vision of the good life was. The vision of the good life. That we still have them for our teens that are around. That there is this general understanding and cultural expectation and conventional wisdom that if you want a good paying job, you got to go get a college education. Now, there might be a little bit of truth to it, but there might not be. Bill Gates dropped out of Stanford, man. So there's a whole nother component that this conventional wisdom may or may not have, but that we oftentimes operate out of that social and conventional wisdom without really giving much thought to what we are doing. Esau and Jacob find themselves in that type of position where they're following the social conventions of their day. The only one of the family, we have Isaac, who is dad, Rebekah, who is mom, Esau, firstborn, Jacob, secondborn. The only one who has even given thought to maybe the lives of their children, the children are going to be a little different, is Rebekah. Rebekah has been given this word over the lives of Jacob and Esau, that the older will serve the younger, flipping the script of the social convention of the day. This isn't necessarily a surprise, I suppose. Abraham had two sons. One was Ishmael, who was the oldest, but it was Isaac who was the child of blessing. But that Isaac obviously didn't get the memo. It says right here in the text that in verse 28, Isaac loved Esau. His intention, which we'll talk about next week, is that the blessing of the family and that the leadership of the family is going to rest on the oldest. We don't know did Rebecca keep this oracle to herself? Did she not tell anybody, her husband, her children, that God's intention was that the younger would serve the older? You see, I want to say that Esau, chasing after the social convention of his day, he finds himself in incredible tension. Because he finds out that following the social norms and social conventions of his day, he finds himself in opposition to the plan that God had for him from the very beginning. That the plan that God had for Jacob and Esau looked very different than the way that the world around them was telling them that they needed to interact with one another. And that in Esau fighting that, Esau finding himself in that place of conflict with the purposes and plans of God for his life, he finds himself in conflict with other people. His brother, namely. So that there's this conflict of relationship that occurs there between Jacob and Esau. And that I'm suggesting to you that it's really starting from the fact that Esau, I'd say Jacob too, but that Esau never paused to actually consider what was God's reality for his life. What was God's design for who he was meant to be? We got to probe that a little bit more. So kind of what I'm saying is this, is yes, there is conflict between Jacob and Esau, and it will escalate, as we will see next week. And that it will escalate to the point where Esau wants to kill his brother. But that I would share with you that this narrative isn't so much about the conflict between Esau and Jacob, that rather this narrative is really about the conflict between Esau and Esau. Let me say that again. That this narrative that we need to lean into today isn't so much about the conflict between Jacob and Esau as much as it's about the conflict between Esau and Esau. What do I mean by that? Jacob had a plan. And he found out that the plan had been thwarted. The plan had not worked the way that he anticipated it working. He was going to have his birthright. He was going to end up having the blessing, which we'll talk about next week. In that it is taken away for whatever reason, and that it comes to the point where that plan comes to the point that at the end of this, in verse 34, Esau despises his birthright. He hates the fact that this was supposed to be the plan for his life. This was the way that it was supposed to work. This is the way that he envisioned his white picket fence with his 2.5 kids and a dog and a cat, and that now he wants nothing. He can't stand the fact that that's the way it was supposed to be, and someone ripped it from his hands. I want to suggest to us, because of the absence of the text, that I really wonder if Esau ever really pursued the face of God. Probably not until much later in his life. Did he ever really lean in to go, what's God have to say about what's going on for me? Did he ever really pause long enough to say, you know what, maybe God's got something else in store for me? And that my suggestion to us today is that I know that I can do that. I can be like Esau really easily, where I don't take the time to stop and hear the voice of God speaking over my life and asking me to lean in faithful obedience to that which he is calling me to and what he's speaking to me. Have you really taken the time? Have you taken the time, the energy, and the effort to really pause and allow the voice of God to speak over you? He has a plan for you. He has a desire to bless your life. It might not look anything like the blessings you expect it to look like, just like Esau. And that's okay, because guess what? God knows you better than you know yourself. And that God's desire for you is the absolute best. He knows what's best for you. It's one of the problems when we start talking about what do you need. When someone said, what do you need? Heather asked me for Christmas. Evan, what do you need for Christmas? I don't know. I don't know what I need. I don't really have a need. Then the question changed. What do you want for Christmas? And I don't know. I don't want anything. I don't know. I have no idea. But anyway. But that when we talk about needs, the problem is that I need to be honest. I don't really know what I need. And that there can be lots of people that can try to tell me what I need. But in all reality, I don't know what I need. God knows what I need because he knows me better than I know myself. The core of this issue is, are you taking the time to go to the one who knows you, who knows your needs? Are you pausing long enough in prayer? Are you coming to him before him in worship and adoration to say, God, you know me better than I know myself. Please tell me the story of my life that needs to be lived out from here. That's core number one. That's something that we need to be pursuing. And I encourage you to do it, because I honestly believe Isaac didn't do it for his children. Otherwise, he wouldn't have desired to bless Esau. He would have sought after the face of God, and he would have said, this is really awkward, but I'm going to bless Jacob instead. My guess is Jacob and Esau didn't do it, because if Jacob did it, maybe Jacob did know. Maybe his mother told him, and he decided to try to do it on his own strength. Is that he tried to take it into his own hands and say, I'm going to fulfill God's purposes for my life by myself, because I can't bank on God doing it, which sounds a whole lot like Jacob. But my guess is that Esau probably just leaned on the fact, I'm the oldest. I have a position of privilege. I have the resources. My life is going to be just fine. And I'm going to get exactly what I want. Now, there's something interesting here. I have to think to myself, if I was Esau, and I'm pressing into this idea of seeking the face of God for a plan for my life, and I go, if I had mom say, hey, mom comes to me and says, hey, you really should pray and ask God to show you what you're supposed to be doing, what life is supposed to look like. I can imagine that if I did that, and that God told me probably something similar to what God tells Rebecca, that the older shall serve the younger, and that the younger one's going to be stronger than the older one, and I'm the older son, I'm probably going to go, why in the world did I seek God on this? Because that's really bad news. Right? No one wants to tell you that your descendants are going to be servants to your younger brother's family the rest of, you know, for eternity. Honestly, that doesn't sound like good news to me. You mean I'm gonna have to clean up after my younger brother the rest of my days? Oh, great. I'm so glad that I went to God with that one. This is the problem with this, because I know that reality. There are days where I'm like, I don't know if I really want to talk to God, because I don't know if I really want to hear what God has to tell me. Because if I hear it from God, then I'm responsible to do what God tells me. And that is uncomfortable, because sometimes I don't want to do what God tells me to do. My guess is you're the same way. But that if Esau did lean in, and we lean in, and we hear the voice of God, that part of the reality is that it's not our job to then squabble with God about this is what I want to do or not want to do, or I don't like that enough. Our responsible place before God is to go, you know me better than I know myself. I'm going to pursue what you tell me to do, even if it doesn't make sense or is uncomfortable to me. It's the pattern of Jesus Christ, who does nothing apart from his Father telling him what to do. As he says in John, I've done nothing, I've said nothing apart from what the Father has given me. It's Jesus saying, your will be done, not mine. And that is incredibly miserable at times, but that Jesus sets us as a pattern for us to lean into that reality. And that this is where the rubber meets the road, is when we hear the voice of God, are we willing to obediently humble ourselves and surrender to the voice of God, saying, this is what I am to be? There's a wonderful gentleman, give an example of how this meshes into our conventional wisdom. I mentioned earlier, this is an example that would connect deeply with what we talked about earlier, that the conventional wisdom of our day is that you go to college, you get a job, you pay your college debt off, you find a spouse, you have kids, and you know, you work up the corporate ladder to make sure that you can get a good pension, those types of things. And that if you do all those things, you're going to be happy, you're going to have resources, you're going to get to go on vacation, you're going to do all that stuff. Wonderful kid. He's not a kid anymore, but he was a wonderful kid that was in a youth group that Heather, in the church that Heather actually grew up in. His name is Austin. Austin, great kid of faith, met Jesus while he was a teen and ended up going to college, getting involved in computers, ended up getting a great job close to home, and ended up getting this job, and he was set. He was not married yet, didn't really have a girl on the horizon from my understanding, but that he was working, he was starting to pay off his debt, and that there was this general unsettledness in him, as he describes it. This recognition that there was something missing. There had to be more to life than just going through the motions of going to work, making the paycheck, paying the bills, doing those types of things. And he recognized God. He started to seek the face of God. And he started saying, God, what is this? What is more? There's got to be something else. And that he recognized this, that God was calling him into something incredibly radical in comparison to what everybody would tell him, what is this wise and smart thing to do? The wise and smart thing to do would be to continue in your career. Go figure out ways to go branch and be yourself in some ways, but continue to pay, make sure you're making that money and you're paying those bills off and you're making it happen. And that what he heard the voice of God tell him, you need to go on mission for a year. And so he applies and gets accepted to a program, a 12-month program. The first month was training, and that the subsequent 11 months, he went to 11 different countries, one each month, preaching the gospel and serving the poor and needy of the world. Let me tell you, from what he told us, and Heather and I know his parents were not happy campers. But that the reality was is that Austin, this incredible man of faith that set aside all that the world told him was good and that he was going to prosper in, he set it all aside and that he pursued this. And you know what? As he found that the fulfillment of God's design for his life was greater than anything the world could offer him, period. And that though he didn't have the same amount of money, he didn't go back to his IT job. You want to know what happened? He ended up getting hired by the missions organization to go help other young adults find their passion and purpose and God-designed fulfillment for their life. Awesome, awesome story. Austin is an incredible, incredible person. But the reality is I wonder how many of us would find ourselves stuck in that 9-to-5 grind in recognizing that our life is unfulfilled and that we would never press forward to seek the face of God, number one. And if we did, that we would go, I can't do that because it's too risky. I can't do that because so-and-so will be upset with me. I can't do that because what are my parents going to think? I can't do that because what are my children going to think? I can't do those things. And that the reality is Austin chose what was best. Austin chose what was God's best for him. And he got to go all over the world proclaiming the gospel of Jesus Christ because God called him there. And he said, I know my parents are going to be upset, but I want God's best for me, not what other people say is good for me. That's what we want. That's what I want. That's what God wants for your life. Is he wants the absolute best for you. And sometimes the absolute best is going to make other people scratch their head and go, that really kind of makes me upset. That really kind of hurts me. But that the best that God has, you know, do you think that God didn't know how Austin's parents were going to respond? I'm pretty sure that God knows Eric and Susan pretty well. And knows exactly how they're going to respond. But called Austin into the mission field anyway. Other people are not an excuse. How other people are going to respond is not an excuse for you not fulfilling the God-given plan and purpose for your life. There's all kinds of other ways that we do this, though. Conventional wisdom says some things like this. That's one piece of conventional wisdom. One of them kind of sounds like this. It goes, the conventional wisdom is that the older that you get, the more experience you have, the smarter, the better you're going to be. That the people that have lots of experience are the ones that know how things are supposed to work. That life is how life is going to work its way out. The reality is that that's not a scriptural statement. Scripture says that wisdom, the beginning of knowledge and wisdom is the fear of the Lord. And that there can be an 85-year-old fool. It has nothing to do with age or life experience. There's lots of life experiences that you shouldn't have. You can have a 15-year-old that is incredibly wise. But that wisdom comes, as the book of Proverbs continues, of the fear of the Lord, acknowledge the Lord in all your ways. He will make your path straight. Are you willing to place the plans of God first and everything else second and third and fourth and so forth and to pursue it? And if you are a 15-year-old that is willing to do that, if you're willing, if you're an 85-year-old that's willing to do that, if you're a 45-year-old that's willing to do that, or anywhere in between, or older or younger, if you're willing to simply say, the wisdom of God comes to me when I am in humble submission to the ways and thoughts of God, that I don't care how old or young you are, you're wise. Because wisdom is a gift from God, not a byproduct of experience. It's another one of those things that we need to recognize, that this is a cultural convention that we wrestle with and that we don't submit ourselves to the ways of God in. This morning, as we move towards communion, I really have two thoughts for you. Number one, have you taken the time to seek God's face? To really know what your role and purpose is? Because your relationships with your spouse, your kids, your grandkids, your parents, your coworkers, your fellow church members, those relationships will never work themselves out the way they are meant to be worked out without first having a humble submission to the ways of God in your life. It is an impossibility. Vertical relationship is fixed first. Horizontal relationships follow. And so that is that where you are? Have you taken that time? I encourage you to do it take the time to set aside, to seek the face of God, to come before him in worship and say, Lord, what do you have for me? I'm willing to go wherever you want me to go and do whatever you want me to do. And that's the second piece then. When you say that, mean it. Be willing to give up what someone's good is so that you can have the best. The best of all that God has. And as we come to these elements, we come to this table, we think upon the person of Jesus Christ. And we recognize that it is Jesus who did give up what was good for the best of God. And that as we partake of his broken body and shed blood, that we would find identity with him to say, God, Jesus, I'm going to be like you. I'm willing to allow myself to be broken and poured out for the life of the world so that I can have the wholeness, the completeness, the fulfillment of all that you have for me.